This is The Best of Our Knowledge, a presentation of National Productions.
Suppose you started a conversation about the U.S. Constitution and the federal court system, you know, like anyone would on a cloudy Thursday. You probably wouldn't expect to start hearing about pirates and mutiny on the high seas. Well, you should.
The British captain began firing from the cabin, trying to shoot them, upon which Olmsted and his compatriots took a small cannon and aimed it into the cabin and shot it into the ship.
Today on The Best of Our Knowledge, we'll learn how a privateer's adventure during the American Revolution helped shape the federal court system. And while we're talking about history, we'll also spend an academic minute learning what part of history is important to you by the pictures you take. I'm Bob Barrett. And this is The Best of Our Knowledge. One of the best parts of my job is that just about every week, I get to talk to really interesting people who are way smarter than me. So when I agreed to interview a political science professor about the origins of the U.S. inferior federal court system, I thought, well, so much for that interesting part. Boy, was I wrong. This turned into a seafaring adventure with privateers and mutiny and even cannon fire. Dr. Matthew Brogdon is an assistant professor of political science at the University of Texas in San Antonio. I asked him what pirates and all that other stuff had to do with the federal courts and the Constitution.
Well, there's a fascinating story that I've never seen it pop up in a textbook, to be honest, but it's really an enormously important episode in our history. I guess you'd have to know something about the law of privateers. Everybody's probably heard something about privateers in the American Revolution, which would normally be private vessels outfitted and authorized by the state to go capture enemy vessels, especially to harass merchant shipping. So in this case, British merchant shipping. And the idea was that a crew could capture a British vessel and tow it into an American port. And if they could successfully do that, then they could claim the ship as prize. They got to keep it for their own and sell its cargo. I mean, this is an enormous sum of money we're talking about. These are the 747s of the 18th century, these big shipping vessels. So this is very profitable stuff. And it also was the kind of thing that could get the country in a lot of trouble. If, for example, you went about capturing a merchant vessel and it turned out it wasn't a British vessel, but it was owned by the Spanish or the French or some other country, you could really land the country in quite a conflict by capturing the vessel. And in essence, then it would be an act of piracy. So the difference between piracy and privateering was simply the law of war.
It's kind of a thin line, isn't it?
It can be a very thin line, which is why it was so closely regulated. And Congress, of course, as well as a number of states during the Revolution, authorized private vessels to engage in this taking of prizes at sea. And one particular episode brought the states and Congress, one particular state, Pennsylvania, in fact, into conflict with the federal government. And I say it gave us the origins of the federal courts because the way that this worked at the time was people would capture a vessel, they'd tow it into a state port, and a state court would condemn the vessel and award the prize to the privateers who had captured it. But Congress, recognizing that this could cause a problem, had created first a committee in Congress and then a separate appellate court. This is really the first federal court in our history, the first court at the national level. They created an appellate court that could then had the power to overturn those decisions of the state admiralty courts. In this particular case, it's this really daring adventure, a young man named Gideon Olmsted, who had been engaged as a privateer during the Revolution, and then a couple of years in, he winds up getting captured by the British in the Caribbean. And before it's over, he winds up in Jamaica in British captivity, and he and some other young American sailors are taken by the British Navy, and they're placed on board a merchant ship called the Active. And this merchant ship was part of a convoy that's going to be sailed to New York to bring supplies to the British Army. And Olmsted, when they got close to New Jersey with a number of other Americans who had been impressed into service on this British vessel, mutinied the ship. They locked the captain in the cabin, Captain Underwood, and took control of the ship, took into custody the two British sailors on deck, And what ensued was quite a drama. The British captain began firing from the cabin, trying to shoot them, upon which Olmsted and his compatriots took a small cannon, a four-pounder, and aimed it into the cabin and shot it into the ship. And then they took another cannon and shot grape shot into the cabin. And the captain, realizing that this was going to sink the vessel and get everyone killed, finally stopped. But after some cajoling, Olmsted and his compatriots get control of the ship. And while sailing it to New Jersey to claim it as prize, after having sort of very heroically risen up from British impressment and captured this vessel, they're actually captured by another American ship. The ship Convention comes along, and the Convention is owned by the state of Pennsylvania, and is a privateer. It's been outfitted to capture British vessels, and they pursue and capture the Active, and they essentially take it away from Olmsted. And instead of towing it to New Jersey, they take it to Pennsylvania, to Philadelphia, to a friendly port where they're locals.
I'm already seeing Olmsted as Johnny Depp, or it sounds like quite the adventure story.
It would make a good movie.
Yeah, it would.
In the ensuing conflict, Olmsted and his friends claim that they're entitled to the prize of the ship that they captured sort of single-handedly. And while the captain of the Convention and another ship claim that no, they had come along, and they essentially, a trial ensues at the state level, and the state winds up giving the prize, splitting it up and giving the biggest part of it to the crew of the Convention and the other ship that had been aiding them. And Olmsted then takes his case to Congress, trying to tell his story, and Congress overturns the decision of the Pennsylvania court, which Pennsylvania then proceeds to ignore. The Pennsylvania state judge just defied Congress, and there really wasn't much that Congress could do about it. The conflict went on. Eventually, Olmsted won his prize in a decision from the U.S. Supreme Court in 1809, over 30 years later.
So this kind of explains a messy start to federal law, or as federal courts, but why did it make it a inferior federal court?
I see. Well, you know, the issue with inferior federal courts, a lot of people are sometimes surprised when they look at the American founding. They look at dispute over federal judicial power. And the weird thing is, you don't find a lot of conflict over the Supreme Court. If you go look at the Constitutional Convention of the First Congress, there really is very little in the way of opposition to the creation of a national Supreme Court. And there's actually widespread support for a power in that Supreme Court to overturn unconstitutional laws, including unconstitutional laws by states. What the most controversy was over whether there ought to be inferior federal courts. And that seems a little odd, because now we think, you know, why, given the importance of the Supreme Court, why would inferior courts, these U.S. district courts and things like that, that handle these matters of federal law, be so important and actually dwarf the Supreme Court in importance? And the answer to that question is that the Supreme Court by itself, without a larger judicial structure underneath it, is actually a pretty weak institution. And this had been borne out by this Federal Court of Appeals in cases of capture during the Revolution. In a number of cases, it overturned the decisions of state courts, and those states were simply able to ignore its rulings. So that made obvious to people that any real assertion of federal judicial power was going to have to be backed up by a bigger structure of more local, inferior federal courts to actually conduct trials, as well as a federal executive to carry the decisions of those courts into effect.
So bringing this full circle, how does this little adventure story go into making the framers of the Constitution put these courts into place?
You know, the interesting thing is, at first at the Constitutional Convention in 1787, when the Constitution's being written, there's a dispute over whether there ought to be these inferior courts. And a couple of times there's an effort to eliminate inferior federal courts from the system. And when that comes up, you get these mentions of cases, particularly there's these sort of allusions to the case of the Active, where there's mentions, well, there were these cases in Pennsylvania and cases of prize and so forth, where we had a problem with a federal Supreme Court overseeing state courts. So this really is sort of a counterexample. Whenever partisans of states' rights at the founding sought to eliminate inferior federal courts, advocates of national power would sort of repeatedly trot out these examples and say, well, you know, we kind of tried that. We tried to rely on state courts, and it really didn't work out very well. It created collisions between federal and state power. The federal government was not able to vindicate its own powers. It seems just to have created conflict. And so what we really need is a full system of federal courts. And, you know, the really ironic thing is that partisans of states' rights, or what I sometimes call decentralists, people who want decentralized power at the founding, sort of persistently insist that, no, it'll work this time. We need to rely on state courts, and then if they make mistakes, we'll have this federal Supreme Court that can overturn their decisions. The real irony at stake in that is that you then have defenders of state autonomy, defenders of decentralized power, positively advocating for a power in the U.S. Supreme Court to overturn the decisions of state courts. But, you know, that irony is not actually all that surprising whenever we realize that what they really feared was the creation of a system of inferior courts that could really carry out federal law energetically. So they recognized that relying on the U.S. Supreme Court instead of these inferior courts would be a weakening of federal power rather than an expansion of it.
So we owe this all to press gangs and privateers.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. Press gangs and privateers. You know, and you see this in the first Congress. It happens again because the Constitution just empowers Congress to create inferior courts. It doesn't say absolutely that they have to do so. So we get this debate again in the first Congress in 1789. They're trying to decide how do we create an inferior federal court system. And again, the same opposition came up. And, you know, the really interesting thing there is that advocates of relying on state courts, when they would put forward their proposals for eliminating federal courts, would usually provide an exception. So Richard Henry Lee from Virginia proposed that there be no inferior federal courts except admiralty courts. So there ought to be federal admiralty courts. And in part, that was sort of acknowledging this example and saying, well, we did have this big problem with captures at sea, and so we do need inferior courts to deal with that, but it'll be fine otherwise. But, you know, most of the delegates to Congress just didn't find that convincing, and they thought that the example of dealing with these cases of capture was really going to be the more typical experience if they relied on state courts. So that's why I think it's so important. You know, I've never seen it in the textbook, but this history of seafaring and our experience with trying to deal with the cases that arose out of our conflicts at sea with other countries really provided a crucial example for the Constitutional Convention and for the First Congress for why they really needed their own federal courts. In fact, you know, usually when you read American history textbooks or American government textbooks, you know, you get references to things like Shays' Rebellion. They said, well, you know, you have these conflicts in the states where debtors are sort of taking up arms against their states to try to get debt relief for legislation. And, you know, there's a lot of talk about that driving the creation of the Constitution and the impetus for creating a more powerful national government. But I really think this sort of experience at sea and our experience with state courts defying a federal appellate court in cases like the Active are just as important for informing the kind of central government that was needed to remedy the defects of the Confederation. You know, Madison had this analogy or this metaphor that I think is really fit. He said at one point that a government without executive and judicial institutions is like a body without arms and legs to act and move. You know, that was really the emphasis for creating a powerful presidency and an extensive system of inferior federal courts that could really carry out federal law directly on people and not be reliant on states for exercising federal power. It sometimes gets lost. It's a little murky. And I think that this is a good episode for illustrating why the framers became convinced of that.
Still to come, our conversation with Dr. Matthew Brogdon continues with a look at how long our present court system has been in place. That's next on The Best of Our Knowledge. We'll be right back. Got any questions or comments about the best of our knowledge? Send them in. Our email address is knowledge@wamc.org. And if you'd like to listen to this or any past programs again, you can find them online at our flagship station's website. Just go to wamc.org and click on the programs link. And while you're there, subscribe to the Best of Our Knowledge's podcast or download the WAMC radio app to listen on demand anytime, anyplace. This is the Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Bob Barrett, and our guest today is Dr. Matthew Brogdon, an assistant professor of political science at the University of Texas at San Antonio. We're talking about the origins of the U.S. federal court system, which led us to almost a sequel of Pirates of the Caribbean. I asked Dr. Brogdon just about how long our current system of inferior federal courts has been in place.
Well, you know, one of the interesting things about scholarship on federal courts in recent years has been that we've come to appreciate just how important the creation of these inferior courts are. The system we have now that's familiar to people, you know, you think about something like the immigration litigation going on right now in Texas, you know, where I live. You know, you see an instance where, you know, the state wants to do something, it passes a law. You've got individuals and other states and things that object to those laws, and they've carried the state into a U.S. district court, to a federal trial court. And that federal trial court issues an injunction to stop enforcement of the law pending a trial. And then after the federal trial, that will undoubtedly go to a federal appellate court, an intermediate appellate court with the Fifth Circuit for us here in Texas. And that the intermediate appellate court will deal with things, the U.S. Courts of Appeals, or we often refer to them as circuit courts. And only after it's percolated through that regional system of inferior courts do those questions usually make it to the Supreme Court. So you can see how that structure kind of undergirds the Supreme Court's ability to sort of look around and pick and choose what issues they want to take on. Without that inferior court system underneath them, they'd be hard-pressed to be able to exercise so much discretion over which cases they hear. And they'd have much less ability to ignore questions that they didn't want to hear, which is a very important power the court has. You know, for decades, we tend to look at the Supreme Court and say, well, the Supreme Court has become more powerful, and the federal courts have become more powerful because the Supreme Court has seized more power, right? We started looking at the way that judicial attitudes changed in the beginning of the 20th century, and we say, well, judges became more activist, and they became more interested in extending their powers. But it wasn't just sort of judicial fiat. It wasn't just judges saying, well, we want more power, we have more power. They needed the institutional structure to be able to do that. And that structure really didn't mature until the beginning of the 20th century, when we got, a lot of people don't realize, we didn't even have intermediate courts of appeal in the federal system until 1891, 100 years into our national experience. So the sort of key features of the federal judicial system are something that emerge over time, and something that Congress has provided for. And there's been a very robust and really interesting literature in the last few years that's tried to explore this process and figure out just when did these institutions develop. Because we're all familiar with the development of the big episodes in development of Congress and the big episodes in development of the presidency. You know, we look at great presidents and the way they extended presidential power. But what is so much less familiar is the way that our federal courts operate. And ironically, it's probably federal courts that are more likely to affect your daily life than, you know, Congress, for example, you know, probably rarely has a direct effect on the way people conduct their daily affairs. But federal courts sort of reach into the details of your life on a pretty routine basis.
Well, even the Supreme Court, by not doing anything, is expressing power.
Well, that's right. That's right. The power to decide not to decide is really an enormously important discretion that the court has. And it wouldn't have that discretion if it didn't have a robust system of inferior courts underneath it. Now, you know, some folks would say, I, what I'm saying is a little bit controversial in terms of the literature because, you know, a lot of people look at this and say, well, we really didn't get these robust federal courts until the 1890s and the early part of the 20th century these developed. So why should we be looking at the founding for this kind of thing? Why should we be looking at the Constitution? Part of the argument I'm making with this, looking at this episode with appellate prize courts, is that really these were the groundwork for these developments was laid very early. So while you don't see them maturing, you don't see the fruits of them until much later, even a century later. century and a half later in some cases, you do have the institutional groundwork laid in the text of the Constitution, and it's laid there because of the experience that the framers had had with the sort of failed experiments of relying on state courts and trying to reverse their decisions and figuring out that we really need a more adequate federal structure. We didn't really get that full federal structure until much later, but certainly the impetus is there and the institutional groundwork is there in the Constitution.
Well, before we go, I guess the one question everyone wants to know is, whatever happened to Mr. Olmsted? Did he make out okay?
You know, Olmsted's experience as a sailor in the Revolution is a really interesting event all its own. These sort of heroic tales of these sailors at sea. You know, he had actually been in a British prison a couple of times, including I think twice he had been imprisoned. British prisons in the Caribbean, and including once in the sort of notorious Montego Bay prison there, and was being carried. The intention was, when they got to New York on the Active, the British intended to imprison him and his compatriots aboard the prison ships in New York Harbor, which had become notorious at that time. Of course, these prison ships where they kept POWs, captured Americans, were notorious for having such high mortality rates, with the spread of disease and cramped quarters and bad living conditions. So, and Olmsted was fighting for his life in a very real sense. So it is really a heroic story.
Dr. Matthew Brogdon is an assistant professor of political science at the University of Texas at San Antonio. If you get a chance, you should hear his lecture called Impressment, Mutiny, and the Seafaring Origins of the Federal Courts. The pictures you take say a lot about your interests, and that includes history. That's the topic of today's Academic Minute.
We all like pictures of moments that reflect the best of our shared history. I'm Dr. Lynn Pascarella, president of the Association of American Colleges and Universities. And today on the Academic Minute, Sahana Mukherjee, assistant professor of psychology at Gettysburg College, examines why this can lead to denying injustices of the past.
How do we remember our nation's past? When you visit a museum, what do you take photos of? Why? My colleague Fia Salter and I examined these questions in the context of America's immigration history. We went to Ellis Island Immigration Museum at NYC and asked visitors to share 10 photos of exhibits that they considered most important. People took more photos that reflected nation-glorifying themes, focusing on positive aspects of immigration history, compared to photos that reflected critical themes focusing on historical injustices. We also conducted a lab study and exposed people to an equal number of glorifying, critical, and neutral photos. Our participants preferred the glorifying photos to the critical ones. And the more they defined identity in ethnocentric terms, so to be truly American, one needs to be Christian or speak without a foreign accent, the more they preferred the glorifying photos. But how does ethnocentric identity emerge in the first place? To complete the loop, we exposed people to glorifying or critical photos. Exposure to critical photos led people to deny ethnocentric identity and perceive more injustices. However, this happened only when the photos were paired with the American flag. Without the flag, we saw the opposite effect. Critical photos led people to deny injustices. So, if we want people to identify current inequalities, we could expose them to past narratives on injustice. But it can be threatening to think about the past in a negative manner. So for now, pairing these narratives with the American flag may change how we engage with our country's past.
That was Sahana Mukherjee of Gettysburg College. You can find this, other segments, and more information about the professors at academicminute.org.
The Academic Minute is a production of WAMC, Northeast Public Radio, in partnership with the Association of American Colleges and Universities. That's all the time we have for this week's program. If you'd like to listen again, join us online at our flagship station's website. Go to WAMC.org and click on the programs link. And while you're there, subscribe to our podcast or any of the other WAMC or National Productions podcasts. And if you have any questions or comments about the program, send them in. Our email address is knowledge@WAMC.org. And you can find us on Twitter at TBOOKnowledge. I'm Bob Barrett. Be sure to join us next time for another edition of The Best of Our Knowledge.
Bob Barrett is producer of The Best of Our Knowledge. Dr. Alan Chartok is executive producer. The Best of Our Knowledge is a production of WAMC Radio's National Productions, which is solely responsible for its content. Hear more at WAMC.org.